You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 100.5 FM.
The maximum amount of money an able-bodied single adult can receive on social assistance in BC is $610. Of the $610 a month, after paying for accommodation, bus tickets, and cell phone necessary to look for work, and basic hygiene, only $109 remains for food, less than $26 for a week. There's nothing for clothes, haircuts, or any social life. The BC Anti-Poverty Coalition raised the rates, challenged provincial politicians last year to try living on $610 for a month. And this year, the group invited the people of British Columbia to try eating on the welfare rate for a week at $26. Paul Taylor is a right to food activist. He's also the executive director at the Downtown Eastside Neighborhood House. Paul is helping, participating in the challenge, which starts later this week on Tuesday, and he has joined me in the studio. Welcome, Paul.
Thanks, Mordecai. Pleasure.
You meet people who live on welfare and try to eat. What kind of hard decisions do you hear them talk about having to make in order to feed themselves or their families?
I think the biggest decision that people often have to make when they're subsisting on welfare is around housing. You know, the portion of the amount of money that a single individual can receive on welfare, so $375 that's allocated for housing, it's really hard to find a place in Vancouver, one of the most expensive cities in the country, at the $375 rate. So often people have to use the portion of the funds, so I guess that's $235, or some portion of that towards housing, leaving them less money to eat and all of those other pieces. So I think that's often a big piece.
People who live on welfare tend to rely heavily on charitable food sources. And yourself, I understand, grew up on welfare, although in a different province and at a different time. In your experience, what does the general public need to better understand about the fact you're driven to subsist on charity?
I think, yeah, charity has become such a default when we talk about issues of inaccess to food and poverty. The problem is charity isn't the best equipped to deal with those pieces and the systemic issues that cause people to rely on charity. So I think often charitable food that's made available, one, is often Eurocentric. So that certainly marginalizes a group of folks trying to access this charity. The whole process is often degrading. It's based on other people's leftovers. It's often food that's passed or close to its due date, or food with bumps and dents. You know, this is food that supports negative health outcomes for poor people, people in general. It's inconsistent as well. You know, so during this time of year, we'll see, particularly in the community that I work in, we'll see a ubiquity of turkey. There's a whole bunch of turkey and mashed potatoes in the downtown east side. But, you know, in February or March, someone in the downtown east side dependent on charity, you know, says, can I have some of that lovely turkey that I had in December? They're looked at as if they're from another planet, you know.
What are your personal concerns? You're going to be taking up this challenge to live on $26 a week for food. What does that mean for you?
You know, I the biggest thing for me is I realize that food has an incredible capacity to bring people together, you know, build community, a mechanism for sharing and creation of wonderful conversation. So I think certainly I won't be able to accept any dinner invitations. I won't be able to offer anything. You know, I'm quite frightened that I certainly won't be able to do this, but I'm less concerned about not being able to do this. You know, the reason I'm participating is because I'm excited about the opportunity to participate in animating this dialogue. I think far too few of us know the reality of what it means to live on $26. So I think for a week, I think going through the thought process of how do I make these choices around what I'm going to eat? What am I losing? What am I not going to be eating? What am I going to have to give up? What becomes a luxury? I think that's a type of thinking that will go a long way in moving forward this discussion.
Now, you refer to yourself as a right to food activist. many people and myself, I have not heard that term before. Where is the right to food enshrined? Is it has this been recognized by any institutions?
Certainly has. It's been recognized. It's actually a part of our Declaration of Human Rights. So there's the International Covenant on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights. It was drafted in 1966, ratified by Canada as well in 1976, and that establishes Canada's right to food obligations. And I want to say that it doesn't necessarily mean, right to food doesn't necessarily mean handing out free food. It means that the government's required to provide an enabling environment for people to feed themselves. So this is my challenge, and why I'm drawn to this challenge as well, is because we live in this country that purports to have a right to food, but we have legislation and certainly welfare rates that don't allow people to access their right to food. So we have to have this conversation. It's actually embarrassing and awful to have to do, I would imagine, embarrassing to the government that we would have to do things like this and to encourage people to have this conversation, to simply have people eating, you know.
Raise the rates. You're calling for a $1,300 welfare rate tied to inflation. What would that mean for people's ability to eat well, or at least much better?
I think it does a lot of things. I think it allows people to escape charity and make their own food choices based on their own choice. I also think there's an important piece to that. It's that when people have the ability to make their own food choices, they are actually also making economic decisions that charity doesn't allow. So in a community like the Downtown East Side that's going through a great deal of change and is rapidly gentrifying, this allows people the opportunity, low-income folks, to participate in that economic discussion around what type of stores exist and have vote with their dollars. You know, and this is something that isn't available via charity, and is almost accelerates this gentrification process.
Yeah, I always think how natural it is for people who have money that they take for granted that they can choose mm-hmm. what they eat
mm-hmm.
and never think that, let's say, standing in a line at a food bank
mm-hmm.
completely deprives you of any of those things of choice, and it's like then you're sort of so degraded that you've lost that capacity or to simply even control a small aspect of your life.
Not to mention, you know, on a day like today, being out in the rain in a food lineup, you get into a space and you're angry. And the way charity has been animated, it's really based on the person providing the charity. So people are expected to be nice, to be polite, to be kind. Well, my goodness, when I go to the grocery store, certainly everyone in the lineups isn't nice, polite, or kind. You know, so charity imposes these unreal expectations of people who live constant lives of tumult.
Raise the rates, you mention on your website about the differences between living on welfare and eating for $26 a week. What is that distinction? Why is that important to make?
Well, I think it's much easier for people to people who don't have to live on $26 a week to wrap their minds around that and kind of envision what that could potentially be like. And I think that's the piece to this challenge. It really engages people in this dialogue around food, you know, something that we all interact with all the time. And I think it's an engaging mechanism for this discussion.
Charity is so demeaning for people. Mm-hmm. It's not like an egalitarian relationship or a fraternal relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And is this one of the dimensions that you wish to eliminate from that demeaning quality for people who are dependent on charity? You eliminate that by raising the rates?
Absolutely. You know, again, charity. I talk to our neighbors who have to spend hours in these lineups, and they talk to me about the salty soup, the stale bread, the day-old donuts that are omnipresent in the community. But folks who have health concerns, and actually, you know, working in a community where people are disproportionately affected by compromised immune systems, this type of food isn't helpful. So charity and the way it's been animated is not helpful to people. This doesn't provide the energy, the fuel that people need to be productive, you know, what some would call productive folks in society. You know, so it's essential that people be able to make those choices and be able to access the food that fuels them.
When you listen to appeals for charity, whether it's for the food bank and so on, and these go on annually, the people who are giving charity expect something in return for themselves. I mean, it's kind of like, you owe me something because I have, quote unquote, helped you.
This is the challenge with making issues of hunger a question of charity and not a political question, is that people come, whether it's faith-based groups or non-faith-based groups, come with other additional aims outside of the simple provision of food or sharing of food. And I think you raise a really key point, and that's something that we need to look at and talk about.
What are organizers of the challenge hoping will come out of this particular urging of us in who are listening and other ways you're communicating to try living on $26 a week?
Ultimately, we're hoping, you know, as a outcome that the welfare rates will be increased. But in the interim, you know, to have more people understand and appreciate how challenging and possible it is to live, particularly for a prolonged period of time, on $26. It doesn't allow for a margin of error, you know, and there's so many ways in which this challenge is hard for someone who doesn't typically have to subsist on $26 a day to really understand. But what we're hoping it will do is provoke the conversation and get more people involved in this discussion to say, well, wait a minute, this is not doable. You know, I looked at some research that was done in Ontario, and in the last 20 years, the value of a welfare check has decreased significantly, you know. So this, and it continues to do so as the cost of food increases. So this challenge right now in a city like Vancouver, I think, is really important. Also works to challenge the vilification of the poor.
Well, thank you very much for coming in and sharing these ideas and this information, Paul.
Pleasure. Thanks so much, Mordecai.
I've been speaking with Paul Taylor. He's a right-to-food activist, and he's the executive director of the Downtown Eastside Neighborhood House. If you'd like to learn more about the Welfare Food Challenge, you can read about the experiences of participants or register to participate. You can visit their website, and it is welfarefoodchallenge.org.